Welcome to the subtext, friends. I am Brian James Polak. This month, our guest is Monet Hirst Mendoza, and that conversation will begin in mere moments. But first, while you have a device in your hand or a computer in front of your lovely face, please go rate the subtext and throw a nice little comment while you're at it on whichever podcast platform you use. Thank you to everybody who helps us out by sharing the subtext and all of the social medias. I love you guys. Oh yeah, send all your fan letters to thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com and shout all of your complaints out your car window while in traffic or tweet them at the MTA. If you're a Twitter user, give us a follow at Subtext Podcast. I try not to only plug subtext-related stuff, but also share useful playwright and theater-related content. Alrighty. Monet Hirst Mendoza is a New York City-based playwright from Los Angeles, really Pasadena, though. Her plays have been developed with Rising Circle Theater Collective, Astoria Performing Arts Center, where her play Veiled world premiered, American Academy of Dramatic Arts, I almost bungled that one perfectly, and many, many others. Monet is an alum of the Emerging Writers Group at the Public Theater, the R&D Group at the Civilians, Women's Project Playwrights Lab, and the Van Leer Fellowship at New Dramatists. She advocates for equal representation for women, trans, and non-binary writers in the American theater as a member of the Kilroys. She is currently a member of Fresh Ground Peppers Playground Playgroup. That sounds like an intentional tongue twister, doesn't it? She is currently a member of Fresh Ground Peppers Playground Playgroup. And she's a staff writer for Law & Order SVU. I visited with Monet and her friendly cat, who refused to sit on my lap, in her Washington Heights apartment back in July.
I, like, rearranged the kitchen. Of course, like, the worst part was, like, last night we had the flying cockroach in my kitchen. Like, flew from the counter. I saw it go from the counter to the window. And, like, I have an intense phobia about cockroaches. And so does he, but him less so than me. I don't know. I started, like, crying. I was very, like, upset because it flew.
Oh, my God.
And it was big. It was,
yeah,
like, it
there,
was huge.
Aren't they always, though? Aren't they, when they're in your apartment, aren't they always, like, the...
I've never seen one this big. This one was like the, you know, the daddy of them all.
I feel like there's something about whatever these suckers are able to eat inside an apartment makes them grow to 10 times the size that you'll find them in the real world.
Yeah, probably. And you just, like, you can't, there's no avoiding it. Like, I feel like we're very good in our kitchen. We, you know, have things in containers and we have things
right.
in mason jars and stuff, just because I'm very paranoid about that stuff. And regardless, because we're on the first floor of an apartment that's currently being renovated, they're turning this whole building into co-ops.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, this whole area just got rezoned, which is very, very sad. And another sign of gentrification, the cockroaches, they remain.
Right.
We will all be gone, but the cockroaches
will remain. You can't gentrify cockroaches out. How long have you been living here?
I've been living here for, this is the seventh year.
In this apartment?
In this apartment. Yeah, I had, like, a weird subletting situation, and then I became, like, the tenant on the apartment, and, yeah, we just renewed for this month in July will be the seventh time for me. It was cool. I was a Craigslist ad. I was looking for, like, a place to move in after, in Brooklyn, the last time I lived in Brooklyn, the ceiling of my apartment, like, dropped in my roommate's room.
Oh, my God.
So we were like, we have to get out of here. We can't live in this building anymore. I was in the basement, so my room was flooded anytime there was rain. Like, Hurricane Irene was not disastrous for anyone but, like, my apartment. Like, when Hurricane Irene happened, there was, like, it was like a tropical storm where we were. I mean, I think other areas were hit a little bit harder. But in my room, like, got the brunt of it, like... all this water. It's like late at night, and all of a sudden, I'm just seeing all this water creeping.
Oh my God! And you're like, my next apartment will be above ground.
Yes, above ground. Yeah. So I did move up one floor, and here I am.
Yeah.
Here I am in a building with flying cockroaches. I've never seen them take flight before. They have really impressive wingspan.
You know what? I've never seen them fly, and I hope I never do because they look like birds. They look like little baby birds. They're so big.
So it's like cockroaches, baby birds, and dinosaurs. Somehow it's all related. It all follows the same thing. Are we recording right now, by the way?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
You'll see me periodically glance down at this, but don't think anything of it. I'm just making sure, you know, all is good.
Well, I'm sure you'll pick up in some place that sounds good, probably like when I'm talking about my apartment or something.
I always do.
The flying cockroaches. Yeah, no, I definitely cried, though. I was on the phone with my mom, and she's like, "Are you all right?" And I was like, "I don't know." I don't know. I never cry with cockroaches, but for some reason last night, I think it was the wingspan.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was just...
When something going. Like a when something like a cockroach enters your life or your domicile, is mom the person you call?
No, well, we were already on the phone because her birthday's today. Happy birthday, mom!
Oh,
but,
happy birthday!
Yeah. So we were already on the phone, kind of like downloading the day's events, and I just went into the kitchen. to go get some water.
So she experienced this in real time.
Oh, she experienced it in real time. And then she's like, "Honey, what's wrong? What's happening? I don't know what to do. I feel so helpless." Because she lives in Pasadena.
Yeah.
So she's like 3,000 miles away.
Right.
And then she started sending me like gifts of like Ripley from Alien and Venkman from Ghostbusters.
Right.
She was like, "Arm yourself." It was like frightening because she was like, "Okay, we'll go into the bathroom and get the Raid." But I was like, "I can't get the Raid because the Raid is in the kitchen cabinet where this thing is like, it like commandeered the whole kitchen." So then like first thing this morning, I couldn't find it. I thought these cats would take care of
business.
That's
kind of the benefit of the cat,
well,
right?
Yeah, in theory, but these then I didn't find the body, so I think it escaped.
I mean, but isn't that a little scarier? Like,
well, now thanks.
Sorry.
I mean, I think it's fine. I'm hoping that it crawled away, or it's gonna come out in their poop later. I mean, I don't think so, but yeah, I think it crawled away. It narrowly escaped.
Let's say. It crawled away.
Yeah, please, because I can't go through another night of what I experienced, the night of terror. But yeah, this morning I totally like bug bombed my kitchen like crazy. Mm-hmm. So I think after that, he can't come back, right?
No. Because as we just said, they haven't been around since the dinosaurs.
I know, they're like superhuman. They will be here long after we
are. But that's part of... Life in the city, right?
I guess so, yeah. Mice and pigeons.
Yeah.
All kinds of dirty vermin.
Yeah, they're all gross.
It's amazing how many things carry diseases.
Right, and we're just like...
And we're just living
here. All right. If that's what I have to do...
It's true.
For people who actually can't see, which is everybody except the two of us.
Except the two of us.
There's a cat staring right at me, and I'm convinced at one point... She'll just step on the recorder.
I know. I hope she doesn't step
hilarious.
On the recorder. I think what she's probably going to do is try and get in your lap and be like, "Hey."
Oh, that's okay.
I think you need to love on me. She's very, oh, no. Yeah.
We'll just put it up
yeah,
here.
Yeah, put it on the table. See, she really just wanted to lie down.
Yeah. She was like, "You're in my spot, jerk."
I want to be a cat sometimes because it's just, is life just so easy? Hey, stop it. She's like totally kicking Brian.
She's just playing.
Yeah, she's like, "Don't touch my butt." Yeah, she's, okay. They're good cats. They were actually, interesting story, they were left by a former like friend of mine. I used to like cat sit his cats, and then he ended up moving and then left the cats with me. And so now they're my
so
cats.
Now you have cats. How long have you been in New York?
I've been in New York since the fall of 2005, yeah, for college.
So you came here for undergrad?
Yeah, straight out of high school, got on a plane, came here, and have been here ever since. Except for this one brief stint where I went home for a summer between college and adult life.
Right. I think we met briefly in that summer.
We met in that stint where I was just like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing with my life and I'm stuck here.
Right. Right. I think I've known you ever since then, and thanks to social media, I've been a witness, at least to the curated online version of your journey, of what you've been up to as a playwright over the years.
Yeah, I think, I feel like it's funny because I feel like we've only met like twice in real life.
Right.
This being one of those times.
Right.
But it's like through social media, I feel like I know you so well.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what you want to show me at least.
Exactly. It's curated. You grew up in Pasadena and came to New York for undergrad. What was the motivating factor? Like, why come to the East Coast?
Well, I originally wanted to do musical theater. That was what I was trained in. Mm-hmm. I did musical theater from the time I was 7 up until, you know, I think it was 18. And then I switched over to playwriting in college. But I definitely, my mom always said that I was, you know, born on the wrong coast, that I had a very like sort of East Coast mentality, which I wonder what she meant by that now, just that I'm like kind of bossy and like loud.
Was she from the East Coast?
No. She's from the West Coast. So I don't know what made her say that, but maybe I just watched like Annie one too many times. And I was like, I want to go there.
Right.
But I just always knew that I wanted to be in New York, and I came here, and I never left. I just instantly felt like I was home here, like I was always meant to be here, and, I hope I will stay as long as I can.
What was it about the city that made it feel like home?
Well, it's funny because it doesn't feel anything like, California at all.
Particularly Pasadena. I lived there for many, many years. Not many, many years. I lived there for like 7 or 8 years, and this place couldn't be any more different.
Yeah, it's very different. I don't know. Like, I guess when I say home, I mean that sense of home that you have.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's just something comforting about it. So I'm thinking about, like, if I were to do, like, a sort of, like, a movie version of how I felt walking through the streets of New York.
Yeah.
That I just remember, like, very vividly, like, the streets feel like they're humming all the time. There's always people. It's just, like, imbued with energy. And when I was younger, not like I'm very old right now, but, like, you know, when I was in my college years, I used to, like, leave my apartment, like, when I couldn't sleep and just kind of walk around the area. And I was living in, like, Midtown East, so it was, like, 55th. Between 2nd and 3rd were our dorms. Mm-hmm. But I would just kind of like walk around. I'd like walk towards like Bloomingdale's and like look at the windows. And sometimes I would go to Roosevelt Island, and I later lived on Roosevelt Island for like a semester. There's just a quality that just feels alive. That, you know, the cliche is like the city that never sleeps, and it truly doesn't.
Right.
There's always something going on.
Does home feel like home when you go back?
I think my family feels like home, and there are certain places in Los Angeles that feel like home, which is interesting to see, like, now that all of Los Angeles is getting just more and more gentrified. Like, I think the last trip I was home, we went to Highland Park and to Echo Park to visit some friends of mine who, like, have grown up in those neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to be considered, you know, sort of rough neighborhoods, and parts of them still are, but, you know, then I'm seeing, like, condos for sale,
right,
and things like that. And that's kind of a sad sight to see, or it's hard. I don't know if it's necessarily sad. I think because there are some good things that gentrification can bring, like commerce, but then there are bad things as well. Like, the uniqueness of a neighborhood slowly disintegrates. So it's kind of a weird balance. And especially for me, because like I'm a person of color, but I'm also a younger person of color. So it's in a weird way, I'm like a gentrifier in some aspects. Certainly here in New York, I feel like I am. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I live in a very old school neighborhood, but like, you know, I'm the youngest, like one of the younger people in the old school neighborhood.
Do you feel like you don't belong here?
No, I don't feel like I don't belong here, but I definitely feel like I'm, I don't know if I want to say it because intruding, but that also kind of implies that you don't belong here. I just know that I've walked into a place that was made long before I got here, cultured long before I got here, nurtured long before I got here. And I have to hold that with respect.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So I don't necessarily feel like I don't belong, but I'm definitely like not the old school, you know, the old gentleman that you see on the street corner playing bones in the summertime, or the kids running through the fire hydrants, which is like my favorite thing when I'm walking on a Sunday with my coffee and just like, you know, I get a coffee from the deli and like I'll walk around the park, and it's nice to see these bits of life that weren't my experience because nobody opened the fire hydrant in Pasadena
right.
so that we could run around in it. But there is something that is nice about, you know, seeing the Raspa truck on Dykeman, or seeing the guys that are making with the Chinola oranges that are making Morir Soñando and stuff. Like, so those are the which was different. We never had that. We had our Raspa trucks and things like that. Oh my God, that was like a very white way to say that. I was like, the Raspa trucks. We had the Raspa trucks, and we had the guys that would, you know, do the paleteros and things like that. We had those things, the elote guy. So those are things that are my childhood adjacent that give me a lot of warmth. So I guess it's sort of like finding what the substitution is here, right? Like, what are the things that I love about LA that I can find a equal, if not better, substitution for here
right,
in New York?
Right.
The tacos are I'm still looking for a good taco place. So there's no La Estrella here. The La Estrella on Lake Avenue is still the top for me.
Yeah.
So.
But the pizza can't be beat.
The pizza's good, but I mean, here's a crazy thing. It's like, I like pizza, but like, I don't think I'm, you know how people are like, this diehard pizza, this Chicago pizza. I mean, I've never been to Chicago, so I don't know, but.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, if we're going to talk Chicago, New
just,
York, now that I've,
like
I've lived
dish,
in Chicago
right?
for 2 years, I love Chicago pizza and I love New York pizza. The only difference is Chicago pizza isn't actually pizza. It's like a casserole.
Yeah, because it comes in like a pot. Right,
but it's
pot.
Delicious.
It's like a deep dish pan.
It's delicious and wonderful, and I'm sure people will, you know, give me a hard time for saying this, but I love it.
You eat it with a fork and knife?
You eat it with a fork. It's just not, it's a different meal, and I enjoy it.
How come it comes like that?
But when I want pizza, though... I want a slice I can pick up.
Like, shove in your mouth?
And I can drain the grease off for a moment and then shove in my mouth.
Do you have a premier, like, pizza place here that you like?
I don't.
That's what I'm thinking of. I'm like, what is, like, the good
place,
give me,
like, a good dollar, $2 slice. Like, I have low standards.
Oh, you want the dollar pizza. Some people, like, Ugo really loves the dollar pizza. I can't do the dollar pizza.
About it. It's like,
I mean, I'll do if I'm hungry.
It's vitamins for me.
Vitamins?
Like, I'm like, oh, my pizza blood level is low. I need a slice.
It's like a hot shot.
Yeah. Just like, yeah.
I think, like, well, I don't know. Artichoke pizza's good. Like, that's like artichoke dip on a pizza. I like that. I know, but that's like kind of, is that fancy? I don't know. I guess that's kind of fancy
kinda
pizza.
Bougie.
Bougie pizza?
Yeah.
I mean, well, I guess so. It didn't used to feel bougie, but maybe it's bougie now. Now they that's true. They do have a location like on the west side, like right by the High Line now, where you could like sit down and have beer and stuff.
Yeah.
And the one that was like on 14th Street near the First Avenue stop is like gone now.
It's funny that you mentioned offhandedly earlier that you were, you know, youngish, younger, you know, you feel younger than the people that live here, but you are already seem to be have been here long enough to be able to say, you know, things used to be like,
oh, back in my day.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it is interesting to see the things that have stood the test of time and then others that have just gone the way of the dodo because of like real estate or things like that. And, you know, having been in New York since like 2005, now I can really sort of see that progression. And of course, I'm trying to think of a place like right now off the top of my head. I was like, oh, I used to go there a lot and I loved it. Now it's gone. There was a diner that we used to go to. So I went to Marymount Manhattan, which is on the east side in Midtown, or at least my dorms were. The school is actually in the upper, on the Upper East Side. But all my friends went to NYU, and right across from alumni, there was a diner called the Around the Clock Diner. We used to go there all the time. I just remember, like, the menu was written in Comic Sans and on, like, brightly colored paper. And they just had, it's something that, like, would make Gordon Ramsay cringe. It was like a, you know, like a, like, right. Like a diner menu that was, like, you know, 7 or 8 pages long. They had, like, everything there. But I remember everything being super cheap. And I just remember, like, one day I had just a really horrendous night. And none of my friends were up, you know, it was like 6 in the morning. I used to just like stay in like their, dorm rooms and sort of bounce around between like the 6 different rooms that mm-hmm. they all occupied. So no one was up yet. So I kind of just like left, and I went to the diner by myself, and it was just like, it was just like a really bad night. And I just remember, ordering like granola and bacon and pancakes. I just had like a table by myself with all this food on it, and my coffee. It was so sad.
Did you have college envy?
College envy.
Like, all of your friends were at NYU.
I don't know if I necessarily had, like, envy, but I was really lonely.
Yeah?
I was really lonely. So it's like my best friend from high school went to NYU. 'Cause I liked my program. I didn't have a problem with my school or my program, but, you know, everybody I knew was downtown.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, I'd kind of make it through the week like I had to. And then, you know, like Friday through Sunday, I just kind of bounced around whoever would let me in there. And like the running joke with the security guards was that I was the NYU student that didn't go to NYU. Because they were just like, who's signing you in this time?
There's probably a bunch.
Oh,
a bunch
I'm
like
sure.
That, right?
I'm sure.
So you spent all those years growing up performing musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
Did you come from a family that was artistically inclined?
Yeah, my dad is a photographer, and my sister is a visual artist. She did, like, collage and fine art. My mother is a costume designer. She went to school for fashion design and then sort of fell into costume design by mm-hmm. way of... you know, me doing theater, and that was like how she would do like work trade.
Mm-hmm.
So like I would get free acting lessons if she did the costumes for the production or something like that. And I think the only person who is not artistically inclined, so both my nieces, my sister's children, they are both like, they do claymation and animation. They're like, you know, artsy inclined. The only person who isn't is my brother, who's in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But he did do a really amazing production of Annie where he played the butler. And his, like, claim to fame was, like, it was the end of the first act and, you know, everything's in trouble. And he just kind of goes to the Christmas tree and pulls out the Christmas lights and shakes his head. It was so great. Everybody loved it. He should have stuck with it, but he changed trajectories.
Yeah. So the arts were the norm in the family.
Yeah, I was really lucky. I didn't come from a family that was like, no, you can't do that, or choose a better career, or choose a smarter career.
Yeah.
I was very, very lucky in that regard. There's enough doctors and stuff on my dad's side of the family anyway
right.
that are in Mexico. They're all doctors over there. So, you know, we can be the weird ones over here.
Yeah. So you got to Marymount, Manhattan mm-hmm. to study this. What changed for you?
So I actually was waitlisted for the musical theater program. So the first, and I think this also kind of attributed to the loneliness factor mm-hmm. was... I wasn't doing anything theater related for the first semester. I was just taking like general ed classes. But I already knew what I wanted to do. So I think, and, you know, I wasn't allowed to take any of the classes. Mm-hmm. I took a acting for non-majors class, you
right.
know, I think the second semester that I was there, which, and I hated it.
Yeah.
I was just like, this isn't a real class. These people are kind of like just doing it for fun. And like, I'm doing it for life.
Right.
so I sort of marched into the dean's office and was just like, or not the dean, but the, you know, the department head. And I was like, I know that I want to do theater already. So how do I get in here? And in the back of my head, I was like, yeah, but whatever I get into, I'll just change to musical theater. Once I'm in the department, that'll be
Trojan horse yourself.
Yeah, I'll Trojan horse myself. So I got in, with a play that I had written in a theater practicum class in high school. Which, like, it was supposed to be a 10-minute play, and then, like, I wrote it, and I think it's, like, a 68-page play or something. I have it. It's a really, really bad play. My dream one day is to, like, get, like, a group of my friends together and have them, like, read it. It's the first thing I ever wrote. It's so bad. But I really want them to read it, like, with all seriousness. So somehow I submitted that, and based off that horrible, horrible sample, they let me into the playwriting program, which was very small back then. I think now Marymount has like a really nice sized, you know, intermediate and advanced and beginners class. But when I was there, it was very small. It was like six or eight people. I think there were four people in the advanced writing class, and intermediate was small, like less than eight people. So I think altogether maybe the program had like 10 or 12 people if you combined all the classes together.
But you didn't care because you weren't really...
Well, I didn't, like, know. I was
But
just...
you weren't there to study. Like, you were like, I'm in now.
Well, I wouldn't say that I didn't care because then, like, I could take acting classes and then I could take...
No, what I meant about the playwriting
class. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So then I started, like... I started taking those classes and as little by little, I just remember, like, that we were studying, like, Spike Heels by Teresa Rebeck in my acting class, and I was, and my playwriting class was immediately after that class. So I'm kind of waiting in the hallway to go into this acting class, and I'm hearing these two girls next to me that are just like, I know we're not supposed to go out for EPAs, but I'm going to go out for one tomorrow. I'm going to get there at 5 a.m. And I was just like, whoa, 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 whoa. No one ever said anything about 5 a.m. for being an actor. That sounds awful. I don't want to do that. And I just remember, you know, then we went in and I was watching these people do their scenes. We were doing the same, like, two scenes over and over again. And in my head, I was like, I don't understand why this was directed this way. Like, why is the acting teacher directing them to do this? If the character's saying this, why are they moving over here? And so, like, I started kind of, like, restructuring things in my head. And I just remember, like, I went to the playwriting class afterwards, and we did, like, this meditation practice, and then we just kind of started writing, and I just kind of, my pen just didn't stop moving, and I kind of knew by the end of that class that I definitely wanted to do this and not the other thing. So I went downstairs, and I had already put in my paperwork to kind of transfer over to acting, and I was like, cancel it.
Yeah.
Cancel it, 86 that. Thank
was
you.
It really that fast?
Was that fast for me? I think there was just something. I mean, it was that fast, the decision in that particular moment, in that particular day.
Yeah.
I'd probably been doing this for like maybe a month and a half by that time. I just remember it was kind of quick. David Wiener was my intro to playwriting teacher, and he was really cool. He was like, well, what do you feel like writing about? Choose one object and just like go. And I think it was like a nice slow introduction to just getting the words out, just generating thoughts. He had a really cool approach. I liked it. And I remember one time, this was awesome. I just remember everyone in the class, myself included, it was like close to like, it had to have been close to like finals or midwinter finals or something like that. And everybody was just like, I just couldn't do my assignment. There's just so many other things in the way. And he started writing all of our excuses on the whiteboard.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was just like, Juilliard dancers can only dance for 5 years. Maybe 10 if they don't get injured. Like this whole like thing about Juilliard dancers. And he's like, do you think they walk into class every day and say those things? I was just like, whoa. I had never like sort of heard somebody be so frank like that
before. The moment of tough love.
Yeah, the moment of tough love. And then I never missed an assignment again after that. Knock on wood.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember those two moments like just very, very vividly.
But you wrote... You wrote this play in high school. So something was it a class that specifically told you to write a play, Or was that a choice of yours to write a play back then?
No, it was a theater practicum class. So it was just like, you know, everyone was in charge of writing, designing, acting, directing. It was just sort of to teach us about the art of theater in general.
Mm-hmm.
It was an advanced class for seniors only. And so one of the assignments was to write a 10-minute play.
Everybody had the same assignment.
And my sister was going through through a tough time with drugs at that point. And I think this was sort of like a therapy outlet for me that I just didn't kind of, that I didn't realize at the time. Yeah, she was really struggling with her addiction. And I wasn't really talking about it, hadn't really said anything to anyone. And then I just wrote this play about a young girl that's struggling with an addiction and her group of friends. The play is so heinously bad. it's so heinously bad. But, you know, if you're putting yourself in the perspective of, like, you know, like a 17-year-old that's at home.
But it's not heinously bad when you're 17 years old and you're writing something for the first time,
oh,
right?
Like, yeah, yeah, I'm sure. But there's definitely, like, a scene in the desert where it's like, God, it's so horrible. They've, like, buried the friend. It was like, there was a, opens with, like, a murder. At the top. So terrible. It was so terrible. They like get, it's like a really heinous drug fueled version of Better Luck Tomorrow with Latinos instead of Asians. It was bad.
So, okay. Jumping ahead in time again to back to college, when you made this switch, when you were like, okay, give me that paperwork back. I'm burning it. I'm going to be a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to focus on playwriting. What changed for you?
In terms of like what changed, like motivation wise, or just like my general life, what changed?
Yeah, how
for
you
me?
Felt about being here. I mean, did you still feel that loneliness that you were experiencing before?
I mean, I think it took me a while to kind of get out of the loneliness, and I don't know if it was like homesickness. I mean, I wasn't like, I need to go home, I feel homesick, but I think it was just, all of my friends were not doing theater. So I was the only person doing theater. Mm-hmm. Most of my friends were filmmakers or graphic designers. So I was the only person kind of in my own world. And I was just so physically separated from everybody that I hung out with. And I think little by little, I found comfort in reading plays.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had, up to that point, my worldview of theater and what theater could be was just limited to musicals and the very small amount of plays we did at my high school, which, you know, we only did two productions a year and one is always a spring musical.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the theater groups I was involved with outside of my high school always did musicals. So it was very, very small, but I remember reading like Angels in America, which is a play that I now have some problems with. But, you know, at the time, like the angel was like revolutionary to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that you could do that in a play.
Mm-hmm. Meaning have an angel descend from have the ceiling explode open.
Yeah.
And an angel descend.
Yeah. I had no idea that you could do that. Because I think like the closest thing that I got to that was like when I went to go see, Fame on 42nd Street at the Pasadena Civic Auditorium, and they brought a cab on stage that people danced on. And I was like, "That's theater!
What? That's amazing!
I can't believe theater!"
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah, and then you know, just when we studied the Greek plays, you know. Getting different interpretations of that, like Ellen McLaughlin, who played the angel in Angels in America, did like, you know, her own translations or adaptations of some Greek plays that I have here, which I really, really loved. And just, I know, I'm trying to think of like what else. Now that I'm thinking about it, it was funny. We went through our bookshelf and I was like, I'm throwing out all the plays that are by men who have raped women. And then like half of the books went away.
Oh my God, but that's horrible.
Isn't it horrendous?
To think it's that many.
It was that many. There's a lot of empty space on my bookshelf right now. But I remember like Neil LaBute, my first play that I like directed was like, what is that play called? A View from Here, The Scene from Here. It was something like that. I don't have it anymore, so I can't tell you what it was. But, you know, I took up a directing concentration in addition to the acting, and that was one of the first scenes that we had to direct. And, of course, like, here's somebody who like, hasn't done anything nefarious, but, like, I got introduced to Fornes that way, and, like, Mud was one of my favorite plays for a long time, and then I did... Springtime, which is an excerpt of a longer series of plays for a directing project of mine. So there were different things. Paula Vogel, Lynn Nottage. I had a lot of really cool instructors that had different plays on the syllabus that I just didn't know that's what theater was.
When you started to write, when you really started to focus on your writing as an undergrad, did you find yourself, you know, that first play that you wrote was inspired by your sister's experiences. Mm-hmm. Did you find yourself coming back to things that were coming out of your own life?
Yeah, I think at first I was pulling, you know, quite heavily from the shows that I watched. So it's funny because you can see like aspects of like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Roswell mixed in with like my own life experience and what I thought like family is supposed to look like, and dissecting like, you know, the problematic aspects of like family loyalty and things like that. Mm-hmm. So you can find those little threads. I don't think they've exactly gone away. I feel like I'm just trying to rewrite Buffy and Roswell, anything from the WB. I'm just trying to rewrite it in my place. But I think that there's pieces of my mom in a lot of my characters, pieces of my grandmother for sure. And there are little like fragmented pieces of myself in everything. But I think that a lot of playwrights are like that, right?
They why do you themselves. Think it's for you? Why do you think it's specifically your mother and grandmother that keep coming back?
Because my mother and my grandmother were like the matriarchs of my family. They were like my foundation. If I, you know, wasn't with my mom, I was with my grandmother a lot of the time. And my grandmother was great. She was always like teaching life lessons, and then she would just kind of let me play pretend all the time. I used to put up these like these little plays. They had like a fireplace with like a little mantle that had like a little stagey area, and like I would, you know, make everybody come sit in the living room, and I was like, I'm gonna tell you the story of Earth Day.
And when you're little, it's the perfectly sized stage for you.
Yes, right? And I was like, I'm gonna tell you everything, and then I remember like someone would get up to go to the bathroom, and I was like, sit back down, I'm not done. So literally, I was like, oh, you can hold people hostage in the theater. Good to know. Great. I guess like part of my process is unraveling human nature through these two women.
Yeah.
Right? They're so important to me, and there are aspects of them that have become aspects of me and who I am. So I'm trying to sort of figure out who I am through their qualities and then imposing those qualities onto other people and just seeing what'll happen.
Were you aware of what it is you were writing in your first few plays?
No. I think that I wanted to write a story. Well, Veiled was the very first like official play that I wrote, and I wrote that in college, and I wanted to write a family story and make it unique. And at that time, I had just a lot of really complicated feelings about, you know, what was happening in Afghanistan at that time. And that sort of became part of the play as well. And I just love sharks. So I was
can you talk about
adding the magical
this play a
shark?
Little bit?
Yeah. So it's a twist on the Rapunzel story set in New York. It is an Afghani American family that have a daughter that has a rare skin disease where she's allergic to the sunlight, and she wears her mother's old burqa for protection, much to her parents' chagrin. They don't want that same sort of life for their daughter, and she chooses to wear it. There was also a Naomi Wolf article that I had read while she was in Afghanistan doing some reporting. She had interviewed different women who had worn the burqa, and the different views that she had. Some women were very opposed to it, and some women liked it, preferred it because, you know, their modesty was important to them. And so I thought, like, those contrasting views were very interesting, because in America, we just see the burqa as a symbol of oppression, and I had never heard, like, a firsthand account of a woman who wanted to wear it, who chose to wear it. It's complicated. So that's also featured in there in that discussion as well. And then, you know, I love a good fairy tale with fairy tale elements. So I had a talking shark in there that was, you know, a talking nurse shark that is the spirit animal guide. So that I love that play, because I feel like that play is very... it's tackling some big issues, but it's still keeping it kind of light. And that's, I think, like, it's very indicative of a first play. So it's like trying to talk about some different, for some tough stuff, but not hitting you upside the head with it. And it's definitely the first. And then subsequent plays that I've written after that, I think, are a little bit more forceful, a little bit more sure of themselves. But I definitely wouldn't say, like, as fun. I don't think I've written a play, like, that has the brevity and the lightness of Veiled. So that always has a special place in my heart.
Thank you. I'm not sure if whimsy is the right word, but
it's whimsical.
Like, do you feel like you've just lost whimsy in your own point of view?
I've lost whimsy in my life. No, I definitely think that there are moments of whimsy, but for some reason, the stories that are coming to me right now, they're not leaning on the fantastical as much. Well, maybe not. Torero is like the bullfighter play that I have, the female bullfighter play, and there's definitely theatrical. I don't know. Maybe you could call the direction of it whimsical once it finally gets staged, but. It's not a play that inspires whimsy. Definitely theatricality. It's more sweeping.
Yeah.
Also when I was little, I used to watch like epic movies. So it was like Gone with the Wind, Ten Commandments, Cleopatra, Greatest Story Ever Told. My family was just really big into watching these like epic movies. So I feel like actually all of my plays do have this sort of like epic sweep through them.
Yeah.
You know, there's always like some kind of a weird fucked up love story. Well, Veil doesn't have a fucked up love story. It's actually very sweet. And then I grew up and I was like, this is how love is.
Do you think that's what it is? Do you think you just grew up a little bit more and your worldview just started to evolve?
Yeah, I think it's definitely... It's definitely more complicated, for sure. I think the world has gotten more complicated, or maybe the world has always been complicated, and it's just like when you become attuned to it and you're confronted with it, you get more complicated.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, I think when we're young, the world is so small.
Yeah.
And the world grows as we get older. Mm-hmm. Or our world grows until the entire world is our world, and we realize, holy shit, it's nuts.
Yeah. And I think it's, I don't know, it's gotten way more intense in recent years. So,
yeah,
you know, I think being a writer, you do have, or at least I feel this way, maybe others don't, but there is a certain sense of responsibility that we have as writers. When we're telling stories, and it's especially when the world is tough like this, either, you know, we should examine what's happening, or, you know, if we want to be on the lighter side, like knowing what you're providing relief from and providing it in a way that's smart. I don't know.
Do you feel a responsibility to the audience when you write, or are you writing something that might provide relief for you?
I mean, it's probably both, right? It's probably providing relief for myself and relief for audience members. I tend to write about marginalized communities a lot, so I feel a lot of responsibility towards those communities and making sure that they're being presented or represented, you know, accurately and with respect. And that doesn't mean that the people can't be complicated and the situations can't be complicated, but, mm-hmm. you know, I try my best to not put anybody in a position that would be viewed as compromising
mm-hmm.
Or degrading.
Mm-hmm.
I try to be very judicious about that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that that's not the case always for writers. That's a personal mission of mine. Especially right now in this climate, I feel like, you know, you got to be careful, like, what you're saying and how you're representing other people.
Yeah, I mean, careful, before careful, aware, right? Just
yeah.
to start off with, you need to be aware. And I think that's the change that a lot of playwrights who are like myself, you know, the white male sort of like power structure of the way this whole thing was organized for years and years and years, didn't have to or didn't feel like they had to be careful. They could just write whatever they want and say, this is art.
Yeah.
And you can like it or not like it. And that
David Mamet.
Right. So there was this like, I don't need to be respectful of anything. This is me saying what I have to say. And I think some people still believe that and they still write that way. And that's, you know, that's how they write. And then lots of other people feel otherwise.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's hard because I feel like I'm in a double marginalized sort of space. Like, it's interesting because I'm a woman, but I'm also I'm a cis woman, but I'd like to believe that I'm an ally, and I try to work on my allyship every single day. I'm also a mixed race person. So that's an interesting line. You know, there are ways in which I move in the world with privilege, but then other ways that I don't,
mm-hmm.
depending on who's looking at me or what situation I'm in. And it's just a constant work in progress, but I hope that I'm walking through the world trying to get better at being me every single day,
mm-hmm.
and using the privileges that I do have, using that to bring others along. Maybe this all goes back to me being lonely in college, right? It's not a party if you're by yourself, right?
You
need to bring people to celebrate with you.
100%. And I've tried to operate as best as I can in that way for years. Even before I was identified as a playwright, I was a person that worked at a theater and I had access and I knew people and I had the ability to help, you know, make introductions or move plays around, you know, in this mm-hmm. little system that we have in the American theater. And so I would just always do this the best of my ability simply because I could, and I feel like we all should be doing this as much as we possibly can.
Yeah.
Be allies for each other as artists and also be allies for the people in our lives who are marginalized.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think there's a saying that Rising Circle used to have. This was this theater company that I was a part of for many years, that was for artists of color, created by other artists of color. But there was this saying that they had about the circle rises together. So it's like when one person goes, we all go together. And that's something that, you know, if I take nothing else away from Rising Circle, I take that away because, mm-hmm. and I apply it in my daily life, or I try to mm-hmm. as best as I can. And of course, like, you know, we're all human. Sometimes we are better at it, you know, on
sure,
some days
yeah.
than other days. But, that's always something I try to go back to because I feel like as an artist, you know, you have core principles. That's one of my core principles that I've adopted.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's something I'm trying to do.
Can you talk about that time immediately following the completion of your undergrad program.
Oh, yeah.
So at some point, I'm assuming there's some decision point, right? Do I come back to California? Do I stay in New York? And you chose to stay in New York.
Yes. I mean, I would have not gone home at all for the summertime, but my housing option fell through.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to leave my dorm and I had to go home while I waited for another housing option to come to fruition. And there was a little bit of time, you know, it was like 3 months or so that I was like working in Pasadena and kind of, I was like, well, maybe I should stay here. It doesn't look like anything is going to happen for me in New York. We can't find a place. I had three other roommates that were still in New York that were looking for a 4-bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just going to sign the papers and then go, but do it from here, or from here being LA. It just kind of wasn't the same. I don't think I was ready. I think now I'm older and I have a sense of who I am here, that I could go back to LA if I wanted to and mm-hmm. sort of go back and forth. Also, my nieces are older. My parents are getting older. I do feel like I want to be near them, you know, for certain periods of time. But back then, I was just like, this place is dead to me.
Yeah.
I'll never grow.
So it was all like how I have to leave New York for a minute, but everything is about how do I get back?
Yeah. I remember I was working at like Corner Bakery. Is that place around still?
I don't know.
Is that still a place?
I don't know.
Corner Bakery. Yeah. They used to have these like pecan crisps that I would make. It's like slicing the bread and like, God, I hated my life so much. I had to like, I was like, did the morning shift. So I had to be there at like 5 a.m. to make the coffee.
Is this the one next to the Sears?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that one.
Is there still a Sally Beauty Supply over there? I used to go there on my break.
I don't know.
Like, get nail polish. it was by the Sears and the big Whole Foods.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, like over there on Michelinda.
Yeah.
Might still be there. I don't know. But I used to go there, and I just remembered, like, I had, like, this little 62 Ford Falcon that I got from somebody that I used to go to high school with. It's like, this car with, like, I had to warm it up in the morning because, like, it just never went first thing in the morning. I had to warm it up. I'd wake up, turn on my car, go back in my house, and, like, get coffee, wake up, brush my teeth, put water on my face, get dressed, and then I'd, like, jump in. My little car, which was cold because like it doesn't get very cold in California, but the mornings can be kind of, you know,
right.
frosty,
right.
Not freezing, but frosty. And, you know, I'd be sitting in the car and I was just like, come on, baby, let's work. Let's go. We just have to get up the hill. Cause it was maybe like a 3-minute drive from my house.
Yeah.
But I was like, we just have to get up the enormous Michelinda Hill. And I just remember thinking, like, as I was, like, slicing the bread and putting the sugar on it, I was like, I can't do this. I gotta get back to New York.
Right.
If I'm gonna be fucking waitressing, you know, at 5 a.m. or working behind the counter in a bakery, it better be in Hell's Kitchen or something. Like, this, because this cannot stand. And then we ended up finding a place, or my roommates did, and then I moved in, you know, I moved in a few months later. It was great.
It was great that you came back, but it's not that suddenly you're the playwright you hope and dream
hell no.
to be, right?
No, I have
so
like
what I
five jobs.
What I remember, this is the point where I'm now connected to you, and one of the reasons I was very excited to talk to you is about this, the experience from that moment when you came to New York to right now. Because I've been aware of everything that you've shared anyway through social media about how hard it has been to be a playwright just in general, but then become a playwright in this city of all cities.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a lot of work. I hate the word networking, but like that's what it is. Like volunteering at events that I wasn't, you know, those are always strange, being at a gala and working a gala and seeing the people that come through and the people that are being honored when you're working it.
And just wanting to be an attendee?
Wanting to be an attendee, but then also seeing how some of the people treat you, like the event planner treats you or different things. There's always a different you know, hierarchical structure at a gala, which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
But I definitely had like 5 jobs and they were all not theater related. Mostly I was babysitting. So I had like my under the table job. And then I was, you know, working at a theater as like a house manager, box office staff. And I remember like I had this like color coded, like, you know, those huge calendars. Mm-hmm. I color coded them so I would know where to show up for the days, because sometimes they just wouldn't know. Yeah, there was, and it wasn't uncommon for me to have 2 to 3 of the 5 jobs happening in a single day.
Ugh.
Where it was like, I'm babysitting from 8 to 1,
uh-huh.
and then I have a box office shift in Midtown, and that would be like in Brooklyn, and then it's like I have a box office shift from 2 to 6 at one theater,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I had to run there, and then there was a late night show that I was working the box for, so then it was like 8 to 11:30,
mm-hmm.
and that would be my day, so that like that kind of stuff wasn't uncommon. And then it was like I would get home and it's like, oh, I guess I should write a play or work on writing my play. And some days I write and then other days, you know, I don't. It's still not a defined like writing practice for me.
Yeah.
I kind of let now it's interesting because now I'm working in TV. So like I'm a little bit more, I have a deadline. And I got to meet it.
Right.
Go.
Versus, right.
Which is, I find, the big difference between like TV and playwriting. Playwriting is so like, oh, it's very beautiful. You can let your emotions and the wind and the sunlight hitting the window tell you when to write. And then like with TV, it's like, no, this has to be like turned over now.
Right.
So I guess, like the hustle of like.
And how long did that go on where you were working all of these jobs and just writing whenever you could actually find the wherewithal?
When I came back. I mean, like, I feel like in the last couple years, I've had some good luck. Like I was just like applying for things left and right. And I got the Van Leer Fellowship at New Dramatists and then EWG, the Emerging Writers Group at the Public, and then WP Theater, where I had actually been an intern and sort of worked in various capacities.
Mm-hmm.
I got into their lab program. So actually WP was the first. So that sort of set off a wave of things that like started,
mm-hmm.
where things started kind of falling into place for me. So I did that for a long time, but even when I was with WP and even when I was at the Public, I downgraded from 5 jobs to 3 jobs, you know, because I wanted to make it all work.
Do you think these things started to happen because your work was getting better, or do you think you were just starting to, like you mentioned before, there's so much networking? Was it a combination of these two things that?
Probably. I mean, oh my God, this is such a weird question because like I'm not a person that's like, yeah, it's because I did X, Y, and Z. I feel like I was not raised to be a gloater. So it's always hard for me to also be like, yeah, my work just got better.
Well, was there a play, frame it another way, was there a play that people just started to respond to in a different way than your previous plays?
Yeah, I think this play that I had written called Blind Crest, which was like the one that I started to use for all my submissions, which is about a female prison guard and a death row inmate who have a pregnancy pact on death row. And they have an illicit relationship. And I was also examining, you know, the American criminal justice system and racial disparity within that system. And that play just kind of like came out of me. My friend Catherine Carter, who's a director, she brought the idea to me because it was based on a real story. She had read the news article in the Times and was like, I think like you're the person to sort of like theatricalize this story. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely different from like my original idea. Like I was raised Catholic, so I'm trying to always weave religion in there. So I thought that the baby would be like the next Christ child. That was like the original plan. And then I was like, oh, I'm writing a different play. Throw that out. But there's plenty of like Bible nods in there as well. But yeah, I was talking about like the idea of legacy in that. And I think that also stirred in some deep stuff that my family talks about, which is like family loyalty and mm-hmm. legacy and what you'll leave behind. I guess people liked it enough. They responded to it. And then I started getting these things. But yeah, I'd also been networking and, you know, I think it goes back to, you know, this rising circle, you know, sort of attribute of like making sure that you're bringing people with you and like networking mm-hmm. together. So it wouldn't be uncommon for me to go to like a networking event and bring somebody with me
mm-hmm.
and then have that person stick with me and be like, oh, so-and-so, do you know so-and-so?
Right.
Here, you guys talk. I'm going to go over here and like get something to drink
or, right.
you know, and sort of, you know, share that wealth.
That's such a painful part of what we do because so many of us come to playwriting as introverts and
yes.
we need to either have that gear to shift into or develop that skill set to be able to shift into extroversion just purely out of survival.
Yeah, and I find that really difficult. I mean, I am an extrovert. I've always been an extrovert. But I'm also really terrible at talking about myself, as you've seen. so like that's also really hard because, you know, someone who will be doing what I'm doing, you know, who's more established than me will introduce me to somebody, you know, that could open a door for me and they'll be like,
right.
oh, you know, Monet just wrote this amazing play about da 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 da. And then they'll be like, oh, that's interesting. What made you want to write about that? And I was just like, oh, no. Oh, no. I just get really like, do you watch It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
No, I don't.
Oh, never mind. The joke will be lost. But
I'm sure listeners watch it.
Well, yeah, like there's this character D. she wants to be a stand-up comic. It's like every time she opens her mouth, she's like, I get barfy. So she'll be like, hey, what? I just feel like that's what happens to me when I go to events. I'll just be like, oh yeah, I'm Monet. I'm from Los Angeles, Pasadena area, but you know, like, yeah, it's. So yeah, I think it is a tough little battle, but like you have to stick with it and you have to hang in there. And I feel like that there have been many points where I'm just like, and actually right before I got this gig on SVU, I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm so tired of working all these jobs.
That wasn't the first time you had that thought. Like what has kept you going? We're talking about like about 10 years now, right?
Yeah.
From undergrad to today.
Yeah, the crippling fact that I've invested so much of my time and so much of my money, or money I don't have yet, but will one day so I can pay my student loans back. I've just invested so much in this one thing.
Right.
And it's like, it has to work. Because I really can't do anything else. I mean, I don't know, like, if everyone was like, the writing no longer exists, it's shut down.
Right.
No more writers in the world. I would be shit out of luck. I don't know what I would do.
You wouldn't be able to go back to a box office.
No.
Because
no one's writing
there
anymore.
Would be no more things.
There's no more writing. I mean, maybe I could be a bank manager. I don't know. But that's the other thing is like, I don't feel like a passion or a pull towards anything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess, I don't know. I'm stuck with this.
That's kind of how I felt. It took me a long time to come to it. I didn't come to it until I was about your age. But when I found it, it was the most amazing feeling to be like, oh, I have a thing. I have a thing in my life. And the idea of losing that is losing myself completely.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been the thing that has kept me going for all of the years where nothing happens for you. Where all you're doing is going to events and then quietly writing by yourself and hoping something will happen.
Will come of it. Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting because, you know, a couple of people have asked me, they'll be like, so, like, what's the advice you have for other people? And I'm like, I feel like I'm not in a good position to give advice. Like, I mean, maybe I am. I don't know. I don't see it that way. It's just stick with it. Stick with it. I do tell, you know, because I go back to Marymount sometimes to speak to their playwriting classes, mm-hmm. and I always lead with it as a joke, but maybe I lead with it as a joke because it's true, but I'm just like, listen, if you're good at anything else and you can see yourself doing anything else other than this, do it.
I don't even know if I'd take that as a joke. I kind of feel like...
I mean, I say it in a jokey way and they laugh.
Sure, yeah, laugh away, but... This is good advice.
Yeah, I mean, it's just because it's not an easy road. And I don't, like, I would not wish this on my worst enemy. But also, like, when it happens and, like, you know, I've only had one production of my work ever go up, and it was for, like, a 12-performance thing, you know. So I've never had, like a super long run of my work. But, like, even in that, like, 12-performance production, I was, like, so elated, mm-hmm. so happy. I mean, I guess it's a lot of risk. It's a lot of hard work that may or may not pay off. But when the payoff happens, in whatever quantifiable measure it pays off in, I find it to be worth it. And it's like, you know, you're chasing that, you know, for more and more and more.
Had you ever thought about, oh, if I can get a TV writing job?
No, that was recent. I think in the last year, it just became very clear to me that my financial situation was not improving after 10 years. Mm-hmm. It was actually getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
I had gotten an agent following, my time at EWG.
Mm-hmm.
It took a little bit, but I did get one eventually. And I was like, listen, I can't live like this anymore. And I made a concentrated decision. I was like, I want to make money writing. And at that time, I was working at Samuel French. So I had left all my small jobs,
mm-hmm.
and traded it in for a 9-to-5 one day job.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would like babysit on the weekends for like extra cash.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I did that for about 2 years. And, you know, I told my managers, it's like, I'm going to keep this day job because I need benefits, and I need to be making a certain amount of money, and I need to start valuing my time and my health, because, you know, I was running myself ragged and I wasn't happy. I needed dental work done. Mm. I needed to not be paying for therapy out of my pocket. I needed it to come from my insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made that choice for myself, that I was like, yep, I'm going to do a full-time 9-to-5 job, and it's not going to probably be the most glamorous job out there, but this is a stepping stone for my life, not necessary. And yes, it was in theater, so in some ways it could have been a stepping stone for my theater career, but I really was using it as like a stepping stone for my life,
mm-hmm.
for creating stability in my life, because it just felt out of control. And and then, you know, at a certain point, I was like, okay, I've got some stability back in my life, but now I need the money to meet that stability.
Mm-hmm.
And they pushed really hard. My agents pushed really hard. And then I finally got a TV job, like, after, like, a year and a half or so of saying that that's what I wanted. And
mm-hmm.
that's currently what I'm doing. I'm, like, a month in, and, you know, I'm very green.
And is it your one job?
It's my one job.
Yeah.
I literally have no time to do anything else.
I mean,
we're recording this in between like a deadline that I'm on.
Right.
But like, yeah, I literally have no time to do anything else. I wake up, I go to work, I do the writing. And some days it's nice because I can write from home. Like today I'm writing from home. You know, but then other days, you know, I have a little office and I go into the office at Chelsea Piers for SVU and I write there. And that's kind of cool. Like, it's a kind of a dream job. Like, I'm writing for a show that I have watched since it came on the air.
Uh-huh.
Like, I used to watch this with my mom. And then, I continued watching it. It's actually how my fiance and I, like, bonded over this. We, like, got close because of SVU. So it's a, you know,
that's kind of trippy.
Trippy thing. Yeah. It's really interesting. And now I write for the show, for the landmark 21st season. It's very exciting.
And do you feel like this job is all encompassing your writing life, so that perhaps playwriting needs to take a back seat for a while?
I need to figure out the balance. So here's like the ironic thing is like, I feel like, you know, I wrote this play Torera, which got a lot of heat. Although I think Blind Crest is the one that got me this job. It's gotten really successful. It was on the 50 Playwrights Project, 2019, Best Unproduced Latinx Plays. It's still unproduced, FYI, at the time of this recording. It was on that list, and then it was on the Kilroy's list for 2019, and I'd never been on that list before. So it's gotten a lot of attention, which is exciting. And of course, like with that attention, I've also gotten, you know, offers for like residencies that I applied for with that play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I applied for like last year when I had no idea that this was even going to be an option for mm-hmm. me. I was just throwing shit against the wall. And I was like, I'll take a 10-week residency in New Mexico. Yeah, I'll do this. I'll do that.
Right.
And it's interesting that this is the first year where all of the residencies I've applied to, I've gotten accepted into. And I've had to say no to all of them.
That's incredible.
It is incredible. It's exciting.
Think back like
I'm really mad.
Years, 3 years ago. Imagine 3 years ago if the like
timing is just so interesting and like I'm like what a cruel thing. What a cruel thing. I had to say no to all these playwriting things and it was like, oh, dagger in the heart.
But it's both cruel and wonderful.
Yes.
Right? Because you've achieved this great thing.
What is it called? What's that expression? Embarrassment of riches.
Yeah.
I feel very fortunate and very lucky, but I'm also, you know, when you're coming up as a writer, especially as a playwright, you know, we're just so hungry for everything that everything is a yes. We just say yes to everything because that yes turns into experience that we can then use to build upon.
Right.
So it's interesting to be at a juncture where I'm saying no more often than I'm saying yes.
Mm-hmm.
It feels very bizarre. But, you know, it's interesting because for the first time actually working on SVU, I'm writing every single day,
mm-hmm.
Which was not a standard practice for me. I was used to fitting in my writing wherever I could, and now writing is my job, which is a dream come true. I hope that theater doesn't take a back seat. I know that there are other TV writers that make it work somehow. I think probably for this first year, it's going to be like, you know, learning how to do the balance. How much gas do I have left in the tank after I've been writing, you know, scenes for, you know, all the beloved, SVU characters all day. The thing that's interesting about this job is like, you know, it's a lot of research that goes into it, and the research, you know, the subject matter is about like sexual assault and, you know, child abuse, elder abuse, like mm-hmm. all these different things that you would classify as like who is a special victim.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard. Definitely in the first like 3 weeks, we had a bunch of speakers that came in, and a lot of article reading and things like that. And it was just a lot. I came home like super heavy, and I was just like, I'm just going to watch like reruns of Dawson's Creek and just feel great, which Dawson's Creek kind of okay on a rewatch, but I'm still invested. I'm still invested.
Is that another WB show?
Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. I mean, I love Dawson's Creek, but yeah. There's probably aspects of Dawson's Creek now that I'm thinking about it too in my plays, that unrequited love and the back and forth, the love triangle. But yeah, so it's really hard. And I think actually the important thing for this job will be like creating the balance for myself, mm-hmm. right? Since, because I wouldn't say the job is all encompassing, but it's definitely, you know, the majority of my focus is on this job.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, when I get home, it's like, I have to give like my focus to my fiance and like mm-hmm. and to my little animals here, you know?
Yeah.
And then of course, like I haven't even seen my friends in like a month. I haven't seen them since I started this job. So I gotta, you know, we got plans for the 4th. I think like we're going to invite people up and, go to the park or something. So something simple.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it's figuring out how to do the balance.
We should totally wrap up because
yes.
I know you've got work to
do.
Oh
yes, I do.
But there's one other thing I want to talk about that we didn't talk about yet, and that is the Kilroy's.
Yes.
That can you just tell me about the work you're doing with the Kilroy's?
Yeah. So it's super exciting. I'm working with 13 other badass ladies. And what the Kilroys is most known for is their annual list. Contrary to what I've heard, people seem to be under the assumption that we like read the plays and we choose them for the list, and that is not true. We send out a survey to the industry, an industry-wide survey. We inherited a list of about 400 survey nominators, and this year we decided that we wanted to have nominators from all 50 states, and we increased it by a few hundred other nominators. We send out this this survey. We're asking for 3 to 5 plays that you've read that are new and noteworthy by female or trans-identified playwrights.
And do any of the readers, are they given, like, here's how you measure what is noteworthy? It's just they're in their own personal experience, these are the plays.
Yes, in their own personal experience. And anyone can be a nominator, so if anyone listening to this wants to be a nominator, they can just send their name and their affiliation to roys@thekilroys.org. The only thing that we ask is that you must have interacted with new plays, either read them, seen them, be a part of the industry, at least 40 new plays in a given year. And we've have actors, designers, directors. We've asked all different types of industry leaders. So it's up to them to decide who they would like to nominate. This year, we wanted to have writers who had never been on the actual list before in previous years. They could have been honorable mentions, but they didn't make the top, 30 or 33, right. However many the Kilroys did the cutoff point at that year. So this year we cut off at 33. We just literally get the information. We send out the survey, and then we aggregate the information. So we don't do anything with the nominations. We don't read the plays. We just Google spreadsheet magic. And then it's pretty cool because I think actually by deciding to make it so that everyone who was on the list had never been on the list before, we actually found some names that, we've never heard of, which I always think is great.
That's so great, yeah.
Yeah, it was very diverse in terms of, race and age. And I'm actually really excited to read a lot of the plays because I wasn't familiar with a lot of them, which I always think is really cool that when you're helping to spearhead, I want to say that the original... Kilroys, they created like a movement.
They really did.
They really did. And when they were looking for new members, when they were asking people to apply, I definitely jumped in because I was like, I've done advocacy work for people of color, and I would love to continue that that advocacy work for women, trans, and non-binary writers. And that is who we comprise the list of, just brand new playwrights. I'm looking forward to seeing like what else we're going to do. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of volunteer work. There's a lot of steps. So the list is like super shiny and pretty when it comes out, but it takes, takes a lot of months to put that that list together. The previous Kilroys did things like the cake drop, which was where they would bake a cake and, present it to a theater that was actually,
programming with parody.
Programming with parody. Yeah. And it's great. So I'm hoping that we'll continue things like that. And of course, with like a new generation, there's always like, room for us to like throw our ideas in the ring as well. But the list is for sure the main program that the Kilroys does. It's not a program.
Yeah. The Kilroys that you are now part of.
Yeah. And
some of it sounds like the way sometimes you talk, it sounds like you're talking about that group over there.
Oh, I know. That's just me.
It's you.
It's me.
It's
like,
you.
As throughout this whole conversation, I'm just like, oh, don't look at me. But yeah, no, it's an exciting time. And I think right now the industry, there are so many writers that we don't know about. We get to bring them to the forefront or help bring them to the forefront. And, you know, I think that's a big deal. We have like a list of 33 on the list, and then a ton of honorable mentions. You know, it's really cool to see, like, as the results came in and we were sort of looking at the data, just how many names that are out there of folks writing that we just weren't previously aware of. And I think a lot of that has to do with, like, opening up, you know, the nominator pool expanding the parameters just a little bit. Well, I guess it's not expanding the parameters. It's giving a defined parameters. But the previous generation had done that. They did, you know, a year that was all women of color.
Right.
Or women, trans, and non-binary writers of color, I should say. So, yeah, like, and I don't know that every single year we'll have a quote-unquote theme, but there's always next year. I'm like excited to see like what we're all going to decide on.
I'm excited too.
Yeah,
well, let's stop there.
Okay.
I'm so glad you're part of the Kilroys.
Thanks. Me too.
I'm so glad that I got to spend some time with you. Thank you for giving me a lot more than an hour now. Who knows how long the episode will be, but...
Oh, my God. Cut it down. Cut most of
it down. You've got a lot of work to get back to.
Yes.
So thank you for giving me your time.
Yeah.
And I love your cat. I love your apartment. And I love your neighborhood.
Thank you. Thanks for coming to visit me. Yeah. It was great.
Thank you, Monet. Her first episode of SVU will be airing soon. Follow her on Twitter, at Monet Simone, to keep up on all the SVU writers' stuff. Please note, no cats or cockroaches were harmed in the recording of this podcast. Thanks, as always, to American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group, and thank you to Rob and Deep at the magazine for so passionately advocating for the theater community. Lastly, thank you for listening and sharing these conversations. I am always trying to make this podcast better and more representative of our community of playwrights. To that end, I appreciate your feedback. Here we are. At another end. The play filling me up this month is Our Play by Jessica Moss. As a lover of Thornton Wilder's Our Town, and having written my own response to that play, I am a sucker for any new work that speaks to Wilder's. Jessica Moss's play is great. I love it. Go read it.